We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Brett Smith, who is the director of the campus ministry and pastor of the University Baptist Church at the University of Illinois, and he's the author of a brand new book called Labor's Millennium, Christianity, Industrial Education, and the Founding of the University of Illinois. Welcome, Brett.
Thank you, Steve.
Brett, your new book that's part of the Princeton Theological Monograph series talks about how the University of Illinois began with a grand dream for the future. Tell us what millennium thinking was back in the 1860s.
Sure. Well, Protestant Christians in the United States had inherited a tradition where they understood the millennium, which comes from Christian belief as the thousand-year reign of Christ, as something that had actually happened first through Christ's coming, but even after that through the time of the Protestant Reformation. So they saw themselves, the New England Puritans, for example, and others, as building a good society, a new Israel, if you will, for God. So folks had inherited this, and as they came and settled the west of the United States, there was all kinds of talk about setting up millenniums of various kinds. And I actually got the title of the book from a speech from a founding visionary of the university who was named Jonathan Baldwin Turner. And he gave a speech called The Millennium of Labor, where he spelled out this grand vision. And then throughout the book, I bring others into that to talk about, you know, what that meant for them as they founded the university.
Now, when you did your PhD work at Northwestern in history, what drew you to this topic?
Sure. Well, I'm actually an alumnus of the university, and I was serving—
Here at Illinois.
Yeah, here at Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Undergraduate.
Yes, and I was serving a church here in town, the First Baptist Church of Champaign at Savoy, and I was aware that the founding president of the university, they called him Regent John Milton Gregory, was a member of that church, and he was also a Baptist minister. And I was a doctoral student up in Northwestern. It was kind of a long commute, so I was trying to find a local topic that I could research for a dissertation. And so I started digging a bit on John Milton Gregory and found out that his work in the church and his personal religious belief did impact his leadership here. And so I wanted to dig in even further, thought it was an intriguing topic, and sort of went from there.
Now, this is currently a very large, internationally known, very secular university. What difference does it make that when it was founded back in the 1860s, there were these Christian pastors who were pushing to get this started, and the first president was this Baptist Baptist pastor?
Sure. Well, obviously, it's a very different place today. A lot of things have changed. Champaign-Urbana was a very different community. I've appreciated on WILL-TV there's been some recent history of the founding of Champaign, for example. Pretty much a railroad station, the university comes, things go from there. But the demographics of the state of Illinois are very different than they are today. You know, the religious participation in the state was a very strongly Protestant Christian component. You know, so the ethos, the worldview of the people in the state generally more closely reflected, you know, what was going on here at the university. So, you know, total difference in the size of population, a lot of different cultural factors. It's almost not the same place. But that being said, you know, I think it's an important story for a couple of reasons. I mean, it's our shared and common heritage. I think it's important that we know it. From the writing of historical theology, I argue in the book that it's of interest because it locates a social gospel of agricultural workers a little earlier than the urban industrial social gospel is spoken about. So I think that's important as well. And then, you know, just generally for people to understand the roots of religion in a vision of agricultural education. I don't argue in the book that that's true in other locations, but I feel it's pretty strongly present here in the story of the University of Illinois.
And you point out that this was not unique, that other land-grant institutions had the same kind of vision and the same kind of Christian understanding.
Yeah, and it was kind of difficult not for that to happen because higher education in the United States up until the 1850s and 60s, there weren't a whole lot of public schools, certainly not public in the way we know them today. And, you know, folks didn't study things much outside of a what we would now look at as a liberal arts curriculum, you know, training for ministry, training for medicine, training for law. You know, graduate education in the United States prior to the Civil War is mostly limited to theology. So when the public schools are founded, that's what they know. That's what they have to work with. And so, of course, they're looking to the church-related schools for their leadership.
Now, the very first college in the state of Illinois was important to one of the people you focus on, Turner, Illinois College over in Jacksonville, founded by Presbyterians, a specifically Christian liberal arts college. But what did Turner find lacking in that that made him push nationally to get a place like the University of Illinois started here?
Well, Jonathan Baldwin Turner is a very interesting character. He was from Connecticut, and he was he grew up in a tradition called Congregationalism, which dates back to the Mayflower and Plymouth founders. It's that stream of Christianity that came to the American colonies and then spread throughout the nation. And he was a graduate of what was then called Yale College, now Yale University, and actually worked as a minister in the Congregational Church. He had pastored a couple of churches. He and some others felt what we call in the Christian tradition a call to do mission work. And they, in those days, they wanted to bring be missionaries for the West. Illinois was the West. And so he and some others came out to Illinois College to civilize it, to evangelize it, and to bring the light of learning. And so he came here and he actually taught literature and languages and taught Sunday school at the Congregational Church there and was a very popular professor.
And by languages, that would be Greek and Hebrew?
Yeah, and also some Romance and modern languages.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And he got into trouble when he was in Jacksonville. And, you know, it's always hard to find these things out why, but what his daughter said in her biography was that it was because he was an abolitionist and a lot of the folks in Jacksonville weren't. They had come from the South. And so the Synod brought him up on some heresy charges and they dismissed him from the college. So he was really a broken man at that time. It was sometime in the mid-1840s, and I recall him saying in his diary that he was more broken at that age than he was at the age of 90, a very crisis time for him.
And you use a term in your book, Labor's Millennium. He was an immediate abolitionist. He wanted to end slavery right now.
That is correct. Yeah. So, you know, folks like Owen Lovejoy and others who are immediate abolitionists, you know, William Lloyd Garrison, these types, that was where he was coming from, which in those days, you know, that was a pretty extreme opinion.
But that grew out of his Christian faith.
Absolutely. And he was very much a progressive theologically, you know, in his day. He was progressive on a lot of other social issues and, you know, very popular among the students, but not so much among the administrators. So what he did at that time is he had a home there in Jacksonville, and he began to do some agricultural experiments on his own, you know, very much in the tradition of, say, a Thomas Jefferson at Monticello, and was a great admirer of others who did that sort of work. But he couldn't really find an educational system that would do that. And so he began writing friends, college presidents here in the state. I know he had some correspondence with Jonathan Blanchard at Knox, and he said, would you establish me as a professor of agriculture?
Huh.
And this was really something that didn't exist.
Right.
And so he was sort of a man with a calling but no place to go.
And he was a good lobbyist.
Absolutely, yeah. Very influential. This all timed out very well with the beginning of a farmers' movement within the state of Illinois. And connected with those folks pretty early. And as I mentioned, did this Millennium of Labor speech in the year 1851 at the fairgrounds in Springfield. I can't recall if it was the first of the state fairs, but it was among the first. It was all these things, again, were sort of coming together at the same time. And this speech mobilized, helped to bring together this farmers' movement, and they found a spokesman and an advocate in Jonathan Baldwin Turner.
Now, nationally, tell us about the act that brought about the land-grant colleges.
Sure. So there were some other movements going on, and Justin Morrill of Vermont was favorable toward this. And they established some legislation, I believe, in the year 1862 with Illinois' own Abraham Lincoln as president, a friend of J.B. Turner's, that land would be given to the various states and they could be it could be used primarily the hope was for agricultural purposes, but not all states used it in that way. But certainly Illinois did. And Illinois did not have a public university of any kind at that time. Other states did have some public universities, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, that taught, you know, again, what we would call liberal arts curriculum. But Illinois decided in cooperation with the farmers movement that they would use that allotment for agricultural education.
And interestingly, when the Morrill Act was passed, it specified that it would be for agricultural and mechanical, which we today might call engineering, I suppose, purposes, but not to exclude the what we call the liberal arts.
That's right. And in the early years of the it was called the Illinois Industrial University then. There was a lot of debate about this. The farmers' movement was not as keen on the other studies. They wanted to keep it an agricultural and mechanical school. Others wanted to bring in other fields. And so there was a great bit of argument there at the beginning about that.
Now, in your book, Labor's Millennium, Christianity, Industrial Education, and the Founding of the University of Illinois, you give a lot of wonderful quotations from from those early years. Let me read one, which was a resolution passed by the Board of Trustees at their very first meeting, and I quote, "Resolved that sensible of our dependence on the divine blessing and the great work in which we are engaged, it should be a standing order of this board to commence each day's proceedings by reading of the Word of God and prayer."
Mm-hmm.
How many people at the University of Illinois today would know that that was one of the very first resolutions passed by the Board of Trustees?
Probably not many. Again, it was a different day. They didn't have the religious diversity, the religious pluralism that we have today. Actually, a number of the initial trustees were not only clergy. I think all, if I'm not mistaken, maybe one wasn't, were church members. A number of them clergy. A number of them had preached or were continuing to preach. And a number of them, frankly, Baptists. And so they and John Gregory even shared the same denominational ties. So, and that wasn't unusual. Other schools would have done the same thing. Again, that was the era they were in. You know, an interesting story I found, Steve, is that a number of the church-related colleges in the state of Illinois actually wanted to use the Morrill funding to establish their own agricultural department. So they didn't really see a lot of the church-state separation issues the way we see them today. That line was a little more blurry, I suppose.
Now, Jonathan Baldwin Turner was not happy about the selection of Baptist Pastor Gregory, John Gregory, as the first regent or president of the University of Illinois. Why was that?
Well, I think the official version is, and you know, this is what's in the record. He sided with the farmers' movement. He really did want it to be more of the people. He saw Gregory as a little more of the, you know, old school clerical president who was interested in the other disciplines. Of course, none of this is in the record. One wonders if Turner himself may have been interested, you know, in the job since he'd been such a prominent leader. No one knows for sure. You know, there's different theories on these sorts of things, but certainly he did side with a more conservative farmer's opinion. They were wary of even granting degrees. They initially just wanted to have certificates. They didn't want to use regalia. They didn't want to use, you know, Latin. It was all supposed to be in English, all these sorts of things. They really wanted to rewrite the book on higher education because they saw it as elitist and not something, you know, for the people, for the common person.
But Turner's original vision was at least accepted by Gregory in terms of this is education for the common person. For poor farmers who could get an education and be better scientists, be better technicians, do a better job growing food.
Right. Well, yeah, and it's interesting that at the same time, Gregory is in Michigan. John Gregory, the first regent here, was in Michigan during the 1850s, and he was the elected state superintendent of public instruction, and he was involved in the founding of Michigan Agricultural College, which now is Michigan State University. So he had actually been involved in the founding of an agricultural school and was very much an advocate for it as well, and an advocate for Christianity in public education. He made an important speech. You know, I cited J.B. Turner's Millennium of Labor speech. Gregory made one called The Right and Duty of Christianity to Educate, and he used that as his inaugural speech for the presidency of Kalamazoo College in Michigan. So, you know, these are two theorists from different denominations, but they have a lot of the same vision for public education, including agricultural and mechanical education.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Brett H. Smith, Ph.D., from Northwestern University, who is currently the pastor at University Baptist Church at the University of Illinois, where he's been for 10 years. We're talking about his new book, Labor's Millennium, Christianity, Industrial Education, and the Founding of the University of Illinois. We encourage listeners to join in this conversation. Give us a call. This is a live program. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455. If it's long distance, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. So again, Champaign, 333-9455. Long distance, 1-800-222-9455. Happy to have your comments or questions. You mentioned where you got the name for the title for your book. And you mentioned that J.B. Turner says, industrial education prepares the way for a millennium of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out that that quotation is engraved on a building here at the University of Illinois that was originally the agriculture building.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what's it used for now?
I think it's right where the anthropology department
right.
is, if
sure.
I'm not mistaken.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that vision, a millennium of labor.
Yes.
The thought was that things could be radically improved here
right.
on earth.
Right.
That people were not just sort of Christian folks were not looking toward heaven. They were thinking of something that you point out became known as the social gospel.
That's right. Yeah, one of my professors, Don Dayton, is a great recoverer of progressive evangelicalism. That's Protestant Christians who understood God's kingdom made possible in Jesus Christ as working toward the public good in America. So in the 18th and 19th century, you see a lot of social reform movements that come from the Christian churches, and this is one of them. And Gary Dorian's a well-known historian of liberal Protestantism and the social gospel. And, you know, when I was in school, Steve, probably you did as well, we heard that the social gospel really kind of starts in the 1870s, 80s, when there's a lot of urban industrialization in the United States, and people like Walter Rauschenbusch are concerned about the condition of the inner cities and, you know, want to bring a social improvement that benefits everyone's quality of life. Well, when I started digging into this material and researching for my dissertation, what I discovered was we had a similar vision from J.B. Turner, John Gregory, and others that they wanted to improve the life of farmers. In those days, somewhere in the 80% of residents of Illinois were rural, and about half of them actually farmed. And the quality of these varied greatly, but again, we don't have any sort of educational system that teaches people how to grow food in an efficient way, how to deal with pests, you know, all these sorts of things. And it's a tough life for people on the farms. So what we start to see in the Millennium of Labor speech and as this movement evolves is they really are talking about improving the human condition. And they use a lot of religious language for this, a lot of language that comes from the Bible that talks about, you know, people living in an Edenic sort of state, you know, being redeemed, being restored. I call this reversing the curse, one of the chapters in the book of how humankind will be elevated through dignified and noble farming. So they really have this sort of, you know, full-blown high rhetoric about these possibilities.
Now, a phrase like reversing the curse won't mean much to people who don't have a sort of a biblical background. Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, Christians believe that when in Genesis chapter 3, most have heard about Adam and Eve, the first humans, and how they sinned, which is our term for not doing what God wanted. And so there is some fallout from that we read about in the biblical book of Genesis. And Adam, the man, is told that he'll have to farm now. He won't be able to live in Eden and enjoy the fruits of that. And he'll have to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow is what the phrase is, depending on the biblical translation. And so this was something that you see.
That was seen as a curse.
A curse. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. A curse as a result of their own sin, that things had gone awry. And so we really see this idea of turning that around throughout colonial and early national and then antebellum United States, that through machinery and through technology, we can reverse that curse. We can improve a person's state now as they earn their bread by the sweat of their brow.
Now, does it matter whether those early stories are saga, legend, or history?
Sure. I think in those days, people did understand them pretty literally. There probably were some that saw them more as a mythological story. But however one translates that, I think the idea is the same, that we know that we have to work in order to survive. We know that when we go out to farm, there's going to be weeds as well as wheat. And so whether or not one believed it literally, the rhetoric still worked, that we're going to, help farmers out to have a better life.
And these early founders of the University of Illinois, say the first president, John Gregory, he talked to the students regularly, mm-hmm. in a chapel service.
That's right.
A required chapel service. All mm-hmm. the students had to go every day for first 15 minutes, you report, and then later 30 minutes mm-hmm. every day. Mm-hmm. Plus, the students were required to go to a church on Sunday morning in
Correct.
The town. And there was a chapel service in the afternoon that often the president talked on Sunday afternoon that townspeople would come to as well.
That's right.
That's just unimaginable today.
It sure is. And they also had class on Saturday, so they had a pretty busy week. Yeah, that's right. And John Gregory, one of the chapters in the book that I call Preaching Labor's Millennium, I went through all of John Gregory's sermons that are in the University of Illinois archives word for word. I think there are 60-some. And, I mean, it's amazing the language that he uses. I say, it's something you could hear in a Christian church today. And I would deem today we would call his doctrinal stance moderate evangelical from what I read, in those sermons.
And yet he was open to a wide open future somehow. Mm-hmm. You get that sense from mm-hmm. reading those. You give some nice quotations of some length in your book. So you get a sense for what a man of vision he was. Of course, he couldn't anticipate the diversity we have of religions and faith and skepticism and so forth today. But I have the feeling from reading him that he would have welcomed it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there was room among these progressive evangelicals to have a particularity of their own belief, but also to understand that not everyone would share that same belief and that we could work toward the common good. And, in that sense, I don't think it's all that different than what we hear from Eboo Patel or others today that are talking about some of these interfaith movements where you can keep your, own particularity but work together in solidarity.
He even talks back in the 1870s of people who at that time were skeptics, students, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I'm not sure about faculty. I think you say that probably all the faculty were members of Christian churches.
Yeah, that's right. They didn't have a religious test per se, but in the 1870s that was still, you'd have to be the member of a church.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But people who were skeptics, he argues with them in his chapel sermons, mm-hmm. but he mm-hmm. – he obviously respects them.
Right. And again, I think you need to look at the cultural particularity of downstate Illinois. There are some, free thinkers in Chicago and elsewhere in the nation. And I think, do I remember this right, that Bob Ingersoll actually came and talked at the university? I think I say that somewhere in the book. It's amazing how you forget these things in your own book. But for the most part, again, these are students who are from, rural Illinois.
And Ingersoll was a noted atheist at the time.
Yeah, that's right. But these students are from rural Illinois, and, they really come from a Christian culture.
Uh-huh. And a Protestant Christian culture.
That's right, to be very precise about that. Yeah, that's correct.
Right. We're talking with Brett Smith, author of Labor's Millennium, out just this year, Christianity, Industrial Education, and the Founding of the University of Illinois, part of the Princeton Theological Monograph Series. Brett has a PhD from Northwestern, an undergraduate degree from the College of Commerce here at the University of Illinois. So you're an example of someone in business who took some wrong turns.
Exactly. Right. But it's amazing how it comes back now working with a nonprofit and a campus ministry.
A graduate also of Northern Baptist Theological Seminary. And Brett will be giving a reading. Is it a reading as well as signing books tomorrow at
Follett's
right. mm-hmm. on the corner of Wright and Green Street, Follett's Bookstore. That's Monday, May 3rd at 4 p.m. If you'd like to meet Brett, ask him some questions in person. And, of course, if you'd like to ask him some questions on the air, we'll be delighted to have you give us a call, 333-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's a 217 number, of course. If it's long distance, perhaps you're listening online at will.illinois.edu. You may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although Don Noland of Parkland College helps out very frequently, for which I'm grateful. Let me tell listeners who we're going to be talking with in the weeks ahead. Brian Souder will be our guest May 9th, next Sunday night at 5, talking about Faith in Place, the new downstate office for that organization that helps congregations of all religious faiths be involved in the ecological movement. On May 16, we'll be talking with the Soul Miners Children's Theater. On May 23rd, Jack Good will be playing an archive program of Jack Good describing his most recent book. May 30th, Leah Roberts Mosier will be talking about theological insights. And that's some of the guests coming up ahead on here on Keeping the Faith.
Got to put a plug in for Brian Souder. He's one of my students at Urbana Theological Seminary, Steve, so I'm glad he's going to be on the show. He's a very bright person and
yes,
a good leader here in town.
Looking forward to that conversation. Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to talking about your book, Labor's Millennium. Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention one of the, I thought, delightful parts of the book that was a real surprise to me, and that was a hymn that was written that became known as the University Hymn. Tell mm-hmm. us how that happened.
I believe that one was penned by John Gregory himself.
Uh-huh.
And could you remind me of the page, Steve?
Well, let's
maybe,
see if I could find my
okay.
notes on that.
Well, I should mention at this time that John Gregory was the one who came up with the university motto,
page,
Learning and Labor.
Page 50.
Okay.
Well, not quite.
Yeah, the university anthem.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he wrote a number of these songs that they used in worship, especially early on. And the idea of learning and labor was that, you know, again, this reversing the curse idea of elevating the farmer would be the labor part. And then by giving that learning, putting these two together, which they said had been, you know, corrupted again by the problem of sin, that they'd been separated, that then everyone would be, you know, blessed by this. And so would you like to read some of?
Why don't you?
Okay. So imagine, folks, you are at an event. This was for the inauguration ceremony of the University of Illinois, March 11, 1868. And everyone there sings this song. The first stanza says, "We hail thee, great fountain of learning and light. There's life in thy radiance. There's hope in thy might. We greet now thy dawning, but what singer's rhyme shall follow the course down the ages of time? Over homes of the millions, over fields of rich toil, thy science shall shine as the sun shines on soil. And learning and labor, fit head for fit hand, shall crown with twin glories our broad prairie land."
"And as generations in the grand march of time shall toil the long ages with numbers sublime, thy portals shall throng with the lowly and the great. Thy science-crowned children shall bless all the state," capitalize the state of Illinois. "Then hail thee, blessed fountain of learning and light, shine in thy glory, raise ever in might. We greet now thy dawning, but ages to come must tell of thy grandeur and shout, harvest home.
Being, of course, a millennial image, right?
Sure.
That God's kingdom is here because we have all this food now and we don't have to work too much for it. And I guess we're the ages to come. We're the ones that benefit, I suppose, from all this learning and labor that's been going on for the last 140 years.
And you talk about Borlaug as an mm-hmm. example of what's come in that these people sort of laid the foundation for.
Sure. Yeah. And again, I don't have a direct connection with that, but you can see, I think, in what continues to go on in agricultural education. And, you know, we have seen a great benefit, you know, in that field of study and in agricultural production. And so there are others along the way, I think, who share these values, someone like a Norman Borlaug.
You talk about some of the liturgies, the religious ceremonies that were started at the first 10 or 15 years of the university. Now, how long was Gregory president?
13 years.
13 years.
Mm-hmm.
So during his time, you have a whole chapter telling about some of those quasi-religious, they were blatantly religious.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, it's hard to know how much of that came from church and how much of it came from the academic tradition. I suppose since the tradition came from church, there's not that much of a disconnect. But they do sing a lot of these songs, like the ones we just mentioned. There are prayers at these events. There is the reading of scripture and many, many speakers. This is the age of rhetoric, you know, in the United States, and a number of which are preachers. But there are also some educators who, you know, again, it's amazing to me. You go back and read these speeches and they have all kinds of references to the Bible and to Christian theology that, you know, I guess they assumed their hearers would be familiar with because it was so prevalent within the culture. You mentioned the chapel services. Those are regular liturgies. I call it Liturgies for Learning and Labor is the name of the chapter I devote to this. And then there are also some special occasions, baccalaureate services, where usually John Gregory preaches, but they also invite presidents from other land-grant agricultural schools at times. There are also special ceremonies like the Inauguration Day we just mentioned. There's a ceremony for the laying of the cornerstone of the new university hall. They also have class days, anniversary days, a number of occasions where
baccalaureates as part of the graduation week.
Oh, very much a leading part of the week, and it was a week.
What baccalaureates were, because
sure.
We don't have them much anymore anywhere.
Right. Well, this is a religious service that you know honors the graduates and sends them out, and I focus a lot on these baccalaureate sermons in the Preaching Labor's Millennium chapter where. John Gregory, you know, pretty much tells him, you've been given this education to serve God and make the world a better place. So go out there and do it. And the families that are there and the other guests are sort of edified by that as well.
You talk on page 61 about a new thing for an emerging public university like the Illinois Industrial University, which became the University of Illinois, is to advocate the industrial transformation of society based on religious grounds.
Mm-hmm.
That was just part of it at that time. And I guess I'm curious as to what you think is missing if that's not there anymore.
Sure. Yeah, I think initially part of the attraction to this topic for me was the possibility of some religious engagement in public life. Again, it's a very different day today than it was then. I guess where I'm at personally here, to be a little transparent, is I think we all bring our own values to the table individually and as groups. And sooner or later, I would say that a lot of our public policy results from these values. Some of them are unspoken. Some of them are even unknown. And so I guess where I'm at is if communities of faith can have a voice in that, we probably already do in indirect ways, you know, so be it. That the things that people feel are important, that are really of ultimate concern for them, you know, are able to be lived out. But, you know, it continues to be a tension in our society how we work that out together.
In the days of President John Gregory, much was made of the fact that there were these sectarian colleges, liberal arts colleges that were Presbyterian or Methodist or Congregationalist or whatever during that period. Out here on the frontier, the western frontier.
Mm-hmm.
But these land-grant institutions that got started here and in the Midwest and elsewhere but were called non-sectarian but not un-Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
Explain that distinction.
Sure, sure. That's a big part of this era and this movement that historians look at this time as a transition between what were really, you know, sectarian schools. Not entirely. I mean, a lot of the older colleges, you know, served broader populations and were really sort of non-denominational. But if you look at the proliferation of colleges in the West, they're pretty sectarian, pretty narrow. These public schools gave the opportunity to have a non-denominational sort of Christian influence. And then sort of the consensus on that says, well, over time, this became increasingly secular. You know, people are starting to question the secularization part now. Folks are starting to say it's actually – they remained religious, but they did it on the periphery rather than the institutions themselves. You know, some of these church-state issues started to come into play. But someone like a John Gregory and others of his ilk, you know, really were there in that 20 to 30 or so year window where we went to sort of this non-sectarian Christian feel in a lot of these public schools.
Now, there was objections to some of this early on. Mm-hmm. Some of the faculty apparently voted with their feet, and although they may have been nominal church members, they chose not to go to these required chapels the students went to, and the students wrote in the student newspaper you report making fun of that.
Right, right. Yeah, and I don't know whether it was because of their, you know, sort of a lack of interest from a religious perspective, or just they felt it was kid stuff or didn't want to be there or whatever. But the students thought it was hypocritical that some of them weren't there when they had to be there, that's for sure.
I remember reading in one of the histories of the YMCA here locally when I was director of the Y at the university. There were two different history books written about the Y, which got started here in 1873, just 6 years after the university began. And one of the things I remember reading was that the students would create a disturbance, apparently, and other students would object to that, you know, in the chapel. But apparently there wasn't unanimity about
That's right.
about how nice it was to be in chapel every day.
No, that's right. Very much so.
And to have to go to church on Sunday morning. There were problems with alcohol.
Sure.
In those years, these people who were leaders were strong temperance folks.
That's right. And I actually have a section on that. One of the chapters is about their character formation, and I call it Men Not Monks, which is comes from J.B. Turner. J.B. Turner was very big on the students becoming Christian, quote, men, unquote. And what he meant by that was that they would have these certain character traits to be the kind of people they were trying to build. Of course, the students found ways to horse around like students, you know, always do. And one of the sections on temperance, I talk about some, you know, beer drinking clubs they had downtown and these sorts of things. This tension between, you know, the official stance of the university and some of the activities in student life.
Let's talk about the gender issues of those times. The men were all the male students were had certain requirements that female students didn't have. There were female students early on, but they were really outnumbered in the early years. Although President Gregory had daughters that came to the school.
Yes, and Illinois was pretty innovative in the sense that it was coeducational early on. They were leaders in that regard. I do talk quite a bit about the gender issues in this chapter, Men Not Monks. And one of the things we haven't mentioned so far is that according to the Morrill Act stipulations, military drill was required of all students. And
All male students.
Yeah. And you'll recall that this is right after the Civil War, and it's very important to train and defend, they thought. And so when the female students were admitted, they had to decide whether or not they would be required to do the drill, and they decided that they would not be required to do the drill. A number of the students who were female studied in the what we would call a home economics course and some other fields as well, predominantly English literature. So the curriculum was sort of gender specific. Other than the home economics, it wasn't necessarily intended to be that way. But what I argue in the book is because of the social conventions and the understandings of gender traits of the time, that tends to be where the students gravitated as far as the curriculum.
You had a phrase, I think it was a quotation that I thought was very apt about that gender issue. You say it was really a school for men to which women were admitted.
Yeah, that's right. That comes from one of the professors, and I'm trying to...
Page 75 here. Okay, I found
you.
My notes. Yeah.
Okay. Great, yeah.
A boys' school to which girls were admitted.
That's right, and that comes from Charles Wesley Rolfe said that.
Mm-hmm.
Other than modifying the roughness of the farm boys, the presence of, quote, girls, unquote, did not have any other appreciable effect for a considerable number of years. I think John Gregory would strongly say otherwise, but that was certainly alumnus and Professor Rolfe's opinion.
Now, the chapel services didn't last very long after Gregory's time.
Mm-hmm.
What led to the change?
Yeah, that's beyond the timeline of the book, but I seem to recall the year was 1891. Someone please call in if I'm not correct on that. The student's name was Foster North, and he did say that a public school should not, you know, require mandatory chapel, and brought that to a court case that it was ruled that chapel could no longer be compulsory.
And by the 90s, there was a change in the population that you mentioned in your book, there were people, immigrants coming who were many more Catholics were here.
That's right.
People of other religious faiths were attending.
Yeah, the big story in Illinois is, you know, urbanization to Chicago. I mean, the demographics of the state changed radically from the 1860s to the 1890s.
Now, we're fortunate at the University of Illinois to have a historian writing the history of the university in great detail, and you depend heavily on him in this book. Do you want to talk a little bit?
Sure. Wendt Solberg. I mean, many of you know him and have read his stuff, and I've read greatly from his work on this period and very much informed where I went from there, and have enjoyed conversations with him about it. And you know, as I was looking at that, he wrote this first section that covers the Gregory period. I think it's published it's in the late 1960s, I think. And so what I wanted to do is, given what I had learned in graduate school about, you know, issues of religion and in my field, historical theology, to try to bring that piece into it, you know, of what had already been done by Wendt and others.
Wendt and Solberg, I think, is now on volume 3 of the university's history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the stories on the later years, the way this thing unfolds, definitely read those. It's great stuff.
Yeah, fascinating reading.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Brett H. Smith, author of Labor's Millennium, Christianity, Industrial Education, and the Founding of the University of Illinois, printed as part of the Princeton Theological Monograph Series out just this year. Brett will be reading some selections from this book and answering questions and signing copies tomorrow at Follett's Bookstore. That's Monday, May 3rd at 4 p.m. on the corner of Wright and Green Street. And if parking's a problem, take the bus. There's a lot of buses that get to that corner, about 50 an hour, the last I heard. So, although that time of day, parking is pretty easy, actually, because students are running off and faculty, too. And so by 4 o'clock, you could probably park very close to Follett's. So this is your first published book. You've had articles published. What drew you to the scholarly side of ministry?
Well, I've always enjoyed it, you know, ever since my seminary days. And, you know, I think like a lot of seminarians, you have to make this decision. You know, we believe that God leads us to certain vocations. And, you know, professor, pastor, a lot of people have to make that decision in seminary. It was kind of tough for me. I've always enjoyed being in campus ministry. I had a hard time deciding between the two, I guess. And I also think it's important in Christian ministry to continue to, you know, develop the mind, be involved in scholarly work. This sort of work is not, I suppose, you know, directly applicable to the practice of ministry. But I do think it's important to have this sort of critical engagement with culture and to understand our past. One of the things I like about historical theology is I see it as sort of applied ethics, that we can see, you know, what people's religious beliefs were and how they applied them in space and time and what happened as a result. I mean, it's complicated. We can't understand it fully, but I certainly think it helps to inform our own theological reflection, our own application in our time.
you celebrate many of the good things that came from the sort of Christian Protestant basis that these people who were founding the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. But what was left out? What was missing? What were some of the things that were unfortunate about that sort of narrow Protestant Christian ethos of the time?
Sure. I mean, I think educationally it was pretty limited. You know, part of that was, I suppose, again, they were developing a new field. There really wasn't a whole lot to work with. I mean, by standards today, what was going on in the classroom in some fields would be more akin to what we'd find in a high school. I'd argue, on the other hand, that some of the humanities work was actually pretty vigorous that they did in those days. They were strong in that, but they were less strong in the sciences. You know, certainly there were some assumptions, I suppose, early on that may have been, you know, informed by their background, their belief, that didn't necessarily help the science, okay? But they were able to work that out. It was a relatively new field. That's a possible limitation. Then I talk at the end of the book of some fallout, I suppose, from this movement that they would not have foreseen, that I'd be glad to talk about in a bit, but I think we might have a caller.
We do have a caller. Okay. Let's go to line number one in Urbana. Yes, you're on the air with Brett Smith.
I find what you've men are discussing today very fascinating as far as religion in the early history of the University of Illinois. I wondered if you ran across any comparison with Miami University in Ohio. Here's a case where Robert Hamilton Bishop, a Presbyterian minister, was the first president, and the school was very much like a Presbyterian school for years. Growing out of the Ordinance of 1787, which gave land grants to public institutions that wanted to get started with higher education. Mm-hmm. Were you aware of this ordinance from the days before the Constitution was adopted, and whether there are parallels in what they experienced, mm-hmm. as it now is quite a secular university?
Yes, thank you. I do appreciate you bringing up the ordinance. And again, if there's another caller who can let me know the particulars, feel free. But I do understand there was some way to account for higher education in what were called the Northwest Territories that would have included Ohio and Illinois and these other Midwestern right. states. And, you know, I thank you for telling me about the Miami situation. I regret that I did not research that one. I did compare Illinois with some other land-grant agricultural mechanical schools. I looked at Cornell. I looked at Pennsylvania State. I looked at Michigan State. I looked at Minnesota, and I looked at Iowa State. So I wish I'd have thought of Miami and, frankly, Purdue. I don't know how I missed those two because they're so close geographically to Illinois. But I guess I put out a little plea in the book here. If others would like to look into this, I want to know if labor's millennium is a larger movement than solely what was happening at the Illinois Industrial University, now the University of Illinois.
Well, there was a great deal of idealism about Miami and its founding, mm-hmm. but it was idealism that was often expressed theologically.
Great, great. Thank you so much. I can't wait to dig in on that. And
I did a master's on this at Miami University, and that's the basis of what I have to talk about with you.
I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
And if I could say, if you'd like to contact me privately, I'd love to know what that master's is. I'd like to look at it. And I can – my information's on the web through University Baptist Church and Baptist Housing Ministry. If you'd please email, I'd love to see that.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much.
I might see you tomorrow afternoon.
Okay. Please do.
All right.
Thanks for the call. And again, the reference to tomorrow afternoon is reading at Follett's Bookstore. It's on the Champaign side of Wright Street, isn't it?
It's right there on the dividing line, yeah. Yeah, I want to mention, I really appreciate the caller. I was amazed to find at Minnesota they had a person who was very much like Jonathan Baldwin Turner, and I've forgotten the name. Oliver Kelly, I think, is the name, and they call him the John the Baptist of industrial education. Of course, in the Christian Bible, John the Baptist, the one who says the Messiah is coming. So, you know, again, my guess is there are parallels out there, but at this point we don't know where they are.
Talk a little bit about the class that seniors were required to take in moral philosophy.
Right. And this was something they actually inherited. You know, I say in the book that there were a number of innovations because of the agricultural education, but there were also a lot of adaptations from the tradition. And moral philosophy was usually taught by a college president uniformly throughout the curriculum in American collegiate education. And it was really an ethics class, and it was a it was based upon Christian ethics as taught by the Bible and the Christian tradition. So the students were required to take it. The idea was is that, again, they would be able to steward the knowledge that they'd been given in such a way that they would be good citizens, good members of society, you know, responsible leaders, and be able to behave in an ethical way in whatever pursuit, you know, they would do vocationally.
We're talking with Brett Smith. We still have time for a call or two. The numbers again, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. If you've missed part of this program, you may go online and you'll find this archived at will.illinois.edu/am, and then look for Keeping the Faith or put in Brett Smith, and you'll find this after a week or so. And, of course, previous programs of Keeping the Faith can be found there as well. Let's talk a little bit about the actual sermons preached in these chapels.
Uh-huh.
You have a whole chapter where these 60 or so sermons that have survived in written form, handwritten form, at the university archives, our wonderful archives here at the University of Illinois, where people could go and actually see the words, but you quote a lot from them. Give us some samples.
Sure. Well, the reason I quoted a lot, and I say this in the introduction, there are a lot of quotes in this book, and a lot of times the rule of thumb is, hey, that doesn't make it all that readable. I'd like to say I think it is readable. I wanted people to actually see the rhetoric, you know, just to say, as I did, you know, pouring through these documents and these archives, wow, you know, this is really loaded with religious language. And so I quote a lot of these sermons verbatim. I arrange them thematically, first talking about the style and the method. And I found John Gregory to be a very eloquent speaker, quite poetic in the way he spoke. And then I talk about the content of the doctrine itself. And then I also talk a lot about the themes. And one of the great themes was the building of the kingdom of God, which we mentioned earlier is a big part of this millennialistic, we call it theology, of bringing in God's kingdom. And I'm kind of looking here for something to potentially read, Steve. I guess I didn't come as prepared with some quotes, but...
Well, I didn't mean to surprise you with that, but...
That's okay.
Just some of the... I guess the fact that Gregory so often used texts from Scripture stuck out to me. It was basically a sermon.
That's right. Yeah, I guess I'll read one here. Comes from the 1872 baccalaureate to the graduating class. The call to do good comes as a deep groan, shaping itself as into an unfortunate cry from the depths of ignorance and poverty and sin where so many millions of our race writhe or revel in the muck and mire of deep and almost unnameable degradation, starvation, and sin, bidding you, this is a hopeful sermon, bidding you in God's name and of theirs and their children's sake to do good.
Yeah.
And the name of that sermon is Trust in the Lord and Do Good. I've forgotten the scriptural basis for the text. But that gives you the sort of
the
idea
flavor,
of what was going on.
And
there.
We do have another call on line one again from Urbana. Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. Wasn't there more than reported graft on the part of the town folk to get the university to Urbana-Champaign?
Yes, there sure was. There was a lot of competition in the state for the university, and one of the advantages that Champaign-Urbana had was there was already an existing building, and it turned out to be not much of a building. They were building a new one in just a number of years afterward.
Two or three years.
Yeah, but that – and it actually
was a seminary building.
That's correct. That's right. It was a failed seminary, and there's also some
money,
correct, and a whole lot of talk and a whole lot of persuasion going on there to get it done. That's right. And we mentioned Wynton Solberg's work earlier. He talks at length about that in his first volume of the university history. I don't talk as much about that, but there's a little bit of it in the book.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So Sid was around early on.
Oh, you bet. It's been around a long time, Steve.
Graft and corruption in the state of Illinois.
That's right. Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, it's not new to our day.
It's not all there is, but there is that.
It's kind of interesting, too, while we're on that topic, that, you know, it seemed like in just a casual read here that some of the governors were more interested in the university than others. And some come for the events and some will come and make speeches. But I'll read in the minutes. Oh, Governor so-and-so couldn't show up that day, right? So, you know, varied amount of interest on how important the school is from the government's perspective.
There was also strife and conflict among the religious groups, sectarian groups.
Mm-hmm.
There turned out to be so many Baptists on the Board of Trustees, the first Board of Trustees, that there were articles in the Springfield paper by Presbyterians saying, well, this is not good.
And that's part of J.B. Turner's disappointment, too, that it was too much of one particular sect. And John Gregory said repeatedly that he did want it to be non-sectarian. He wanted it to be balanced. He wanted it to be fair. He was really good at that. He did a lot of Baptist work on the side, a lot of charitable work. You know, once he left the university here, among other things, he was very instrumental. He was an abolitionist as well and was very instrumental in setting up colleges and universities for freed slaves. It's a big mission that he did afterward. But he helped a lot with that. I'd say the faculty was great on that too. A lot of the faculty had denominational commitments, but they really worked together. They set a good example. And, you know, Steve, you mentioned the YMCA earlier. That was a non-sectarian campus ministry that did a great job in bringing unity to the campus. And they also brought a lot of the student services that weren't existing in that time. You know, you asked earlier, what were some limitations? They didn't have a lot of that. And so the YMCA went in there to step up and help students find places to live and find jobs and, you know, provided other religious activities for them outside of the classroom or the mandatory chapels.
Well, we're out of time, and that's a good place to stop because the next thing I want to mention is the University YMCA, which has provided support for this program for its 11 years, is having its Dump and Run annual collection starting May 10 on a Saturday from 9 to 4 at the University of Illinois Stock Pavilion. And this is another way that a non-sectarian, non-religious-based organization is helping with university concerns, things that students typically leave behind and cause problems for the community can be recycled. And Dump and Run helps do that. And people in the community can also bring things to the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue starting May 10, Saturday, and then going Monday through Friday from 9 to 4 up to the 17th, and then Monday through Friday from May 24 to May 28. So those will be the collections for all kinds of things, furniture, household items, anything that students would like, because we'll save these till the fall, and there's a great sale that the Y has in the fall for new students. So this makes some money for the Y, and it helps recycle things. So people are encouraged to bring things to the Stock Pavilion. And this year, it is a bit unusual that we're collecting at the Stock Pavilion because the Y building on Wright Street is having some extensive renovations we're happy about. There'll also be August collections, and the sale again will be at the Stock Pavilion. So that's at 1402 West Pennsylvania Avenue, just east of Memorial Stadium. I want to thank our guest today, Brett Smith, and thanks for people who want to follow this up can pick up his book, Labor's Millennium, a Princeton Theological Monograph series, or hear him read tomorrow at Follett's Bookstore at 4 o'clock on Monday. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Next week, we'll be talking with Brian Souder about faith in place. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.